You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Four Horsemen of the Forever War. How successive commanders-in-chief, from Bush to Biden, got caught in the Afghan quagmire, by Chris Whipple. Opening illustration by Brian Stauffer, which shows a Middle Eastern-looking marketplace in the background with black and white photographs of Biden, Trump, Obama, and Bush superimposed. Sometimes old warriors are the best peacemakers. George Washington famously warned against foreign entanglements. Dwight Eisenhower steadfastly refused to send American troops into harm's way. Those generals knew the cost of war in lives, American and foreign, and steered clear of far-flung quagmires. More recently, over two decades, four presidents took a different path, waging a star-crossed war in Afghanistan, where the United States military has now joined the British and Soviets in what has come to be known as the Graveyard of Empires. In his shambolic exit from Afghanistan, the last of those four presidents, Joe Biden, has proved that ending wars can be more difficult than waging them. The U.S. withdrawal that devolved into chaos, throngs of people stranded in the Kabul airport, panicked Afghans falling to their deaths from an American C-17, scores killed, including U.S. troops in ISIS-K suicide bombings, was both an operational fiasco and an intelligence failure. Leon Panetta, Bill Clinton's White House chief of staff, and Barack Obama's CIA director and defense secretary, watched the spectacle unfold in stunned disbelief. "I had the same feeling that I had January 6th, he told me, looking at the U.S. Capitol, and not seeing it surrounded by National Guard, to deal with a crazy crowd that everybody knew could attack the capital of the United States. I had the same reaction when I saw what was happening in Kabul. The failure of Biden's White House to foresee the Afghan regime's sudden collapse will be a focus of investigations to come. Yet there's plenty of blame to go around. No president, except perhaps Donald Trump, would say there's going to be no circumstance where you see people being lifted off the roof of an embassy, as Biden did on July 8th, unless his intelligence briefers had told him so. I don't think there's any question that the intelligence community dropped the ball in terms of what ultimately happened here, Panetta insisted. A lot of people never expected that this thing would unwind as quickly as it did, but that's not an excuse. The irony is that America's longest war began as one of the CIA's finest hours. The U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001 on George W. Bush's watch was a CIA-led triumph. As former CIA director and defense secretary under both Bush and Obama, Robert Gates explained, it was always predictable. The State Department would recommend the use of military force. The Defense Department would recommend diplomacy. And when they couldn't agree, everyone would decide, let CIA do a covert action. Indeed, sitting at Camp David just 4 days after the al-Qaeda attacks of 9/11, Bush turned to his CIA director, George Tenet. The agency's plan called for CIA paramilitary operatives supported by military airstrikes, to launch an assault on al-Qaeda's Afghan sanctuary. When Tenet was done, Kofor Black, the CIA counterterrorism chief, looked at Bush. "Mr. President," he said, "when we get through with these guys, they're going to have flies walking across their eyeballs." On September 26, 2001, CIA paramilitary operatives, lugging boxes stuffed with millions of dollars in bribes for warlords, choppered into the Mountain Kingdom, linked with the warrior tribes of the Northern Alliance, and swept across the country. Within 10 weeks, they routed al-Qaeda, had Osama bin Laden on the run, rolled up the Taliban, and controlled Kabul. The shooting was over by December. Bush could have declared victory and brought his forces home. Instead, flush with bravado, the president and his advisors left them there and began beating the drums of war against Saddam Hussein. Hubris was the midwife of both America's unnecessary wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Troops and attention were diverted to the ill-conceived invasion of Baghdad. Out of sight and out of mind, a two-decade-long American engagement with Afghanistan had begun. No one had thought it through. "We talk about nation-building, but we really didn't have a clear mission," Panetta told me, "and we sure as hell didn't have an exit strategy to try to make sure that we protected the gains that had been made." American officials were woefully ignorant about both countries. Andrew Card, Bush's White House chief of staff, lamented to me, "I wish that Lawrence Wright had written his book, The Looming Tower, before we went to war in Iraq. Policymakers didn't know the Sunnis from the Shia. It was an article of faith, proved tragically wrong, that U.S. troops would be welcomed as liberators." This was the same kind of groupthink that had led two American presidents, John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson, to wage war in Vietnam. That unfortunate intervention, which lasted 10 years and cost 58,220 American lives, was based on the so-called domino theory. If the country fell to the communist Viet Cong, the nations of East Asia would topple one after the other. CIA Director Richard Helms commissioned a study that debunked the theory, but LBJ deep-sixed the memo, and Defense Secretary Robert McNamara conjured numbers and charts showing body counts that he insisted the enemy could not sustain. George Ball, the Undersecretary of State and one of the few dissenting voices, never had a chance. So it went with Afghanistan. Obama should have known better. He was a voracious reader and avid consumer of intelligence. He had campaigned against forever wars and vowed not to do stupid shit. But under pressure from his generals, Obama kept the Afghan war going, approving a surge of 30,000 troops. He also announced a deadline for drawing them down, which only emboldened the Taliban to keep fighting. "We didn't understand the nature of tribalism," Card told me. "It was a problem in Iraq, and it was certainly a problem in Afghanistan. It didn't help that Obama couldn't stand to be in the same room with his special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, the blustering, self-promoting diplomat Richard Holbrook, who could not stop comparing Afghanistan to Vietnam. Obama didn't want to hear it." But Holbrook was right. As his biographer, George Packer, wrote, "Holbrook understood that all the questions in Afghanistan had been the questions in Vietnam. Could we transform their society? If not, could we still win the war? Did our very effort make it less likely? What leverage did we have? Should we get rid of their leader? Could we talk our way out? In his diary, Holbrooke wrote of Afghanistan back in 2009, "It is beyond ironic that 40-plus years later, we are back in Vietnam. Of course, everything is different, and everything is the same. Every program has its prior incarnation, mostly unsuccessful. Yet the 9/11 difference is also there. Viet Cong plus the North Vietnamese posed no threat to the U.S. Gates will be in the same spot as McNamara. Biden will play George Ball. And I think we must recognize that military success is not possible. Plus, we must seek a negotiation. But with who? The Taliban are not Hanoi. Plus, their alliance with Al-Qaeda is a deal-breaker." Trump had promised to end the war, but as usual, he had no plan. He started peace talks in 2019 with the Taliban, but having announced that the U.S. was withdrawing, had no leverage. For dealmaker Trump, the Taliban's refusal to break with Al-Qaeda was not a deal-breaker. Nor the fact that the Afghan government was cut out of the talks. It was, of course, a show. The Not Ready for Broadway tryout, starring the Mogul and the Mullahs, was supposed to come to Camp David just 3 days before September 11th of all dates. It closed before opening night. Still, Trump set an American withdrawal date of May 1st, 2021, and privately boasted that he had dealt with the mullahs personally. "He talked to the head of the Taliban," a former senior advisor told me, "and he said, 'I know where you live. I know where your family lives. If you harm Afghan women and children or come after Americans, I will do some crazy shit.'" When it came to the Afghan war, Biden had once been all in. During a trip to the country in January 2002, the then chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee wrote, "It was not the resolve of the Afghans that worried me." Famously empathic, Biden had a soft spot for Afghan women and girls whose plight had improved immeasurably since the Taliban had been toppled in 2001. Biden's heart was with an Afghan girl whom he met at a school in Kabul. As he wrote in Promises to Keep, "As I stood to leave, I told the kids, 'I have to go now.' 'You can't go,' I heard someone say. I looked up and saw a 13-year-old girl standing ramrod straight in the middle of the classroom, so brave and so determined. 'America can't go,' she said. 'I must learn to read. I will be a doctor like my mother.' I started to walk over and hug her. 'No, no, no, honey,' I said. 'America is going to stay.'" And yet, Biden came to believe the war was unwinnable. He was souring on the government, warning that it could become a criminal syndicate. The bickering warlords, the opium trade, the armed forces, dubious morale. He opposed almost every troop increase requested by Obama's generals. By the time he decided to run for president, Biden was going with his head instead of his heart. Until mid-August 2021, Biden and his White House team had been regarded as avatars of competence. Against domestic foes, a crippled economy, a debilitating coronavirus, they were the best and the brightest. Ruthlessly executing ambitious blueprints to put checks in Americans' pockets and vaccine shots in their arms. These domestic enemies were surrendering slowly but surely to science and organizational know-how. But an intractable conflict half a world away was something else entirely. Judging an ally's will to fight is not a science. Neither Biden nor his brain trust at the CIA and the State Department expected the Afghan armed forces not to be there, like the National Guard, at the outset of the assault on the Capitol. The ensuing chaos was a logistical and strategic nightmare. It was also a black eye for Biden. His reputation for efficiency and empathy was tarnished. Biden's all-star national security team, one of the best ever on paper, was shell-shocked. As Washington Post columnist David Ignatius put it, "These are people who never got a bad grade in school." Biden, in time, will get credit for ending an unpopular war. But surely, those old soldiers, Washington and Eisenhower, would have done it better. Many outside the administration saw trouble brewing. On August 9th, a week before all hell broke loose at Hamid Karzai International Airport, I spoke with Admiral James Stavridis, who, under Obama, had commanded thousands of American troops in Afghanistan. Sooner or later, the world has a way of showing us that it will have its way with us, he predicted. The first example of that may be Afghanistan, as the wheels really come off there. That's going to be awful to watch. After the debacle, Card told me he thought Biden's national security team needed a handful of really deep contrarians to say, "Wait a minute, what are you doing?" to make sure you don't get gangthink. Panetta agreed. "We don't know whether or not there was that contrarian in the room saying, 'You're about to take one of the biggest gambles of your presidency, and you'd better damn well be prepared for any contingency,'" he said. "I refuse to believe that we couldn't have done this in a better way." Did the ugly departure diminish the American sacrifice? Four presidents spent more than $2 trillion, lost nearly 2,500 American lives, shed American blood, treasure, sweat, and tears, in the words of National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Card thought Biden had sold the American effort short. "Success in Afghanistan," he said, "would truly take a generation. We were just about at the end of half a generation." But a few days after the fall of Kabul, Stavridis told me he'd reluctantly concluded, in retrospect, that the war had been doomed from the start. The central failure of Afghanistan was our certainty that we could create a modern, democratic, centralized government with a strong national army. We always knew it would be mission very, very hard. History should have taught us it was, in fact, mission impossible. Before his sudden death from a ruptured aorta in December 2010, Holbrooke, the maddening, indispensable diplomat, had summed up America's painful naivete about Afghanistan. Sitting through yet another optimistic military briefing, he jotted down something he remembered from a Peanuts comic strip more than 40 years earlier, during Vietnam. It was a comment by Charlie Brown after his baseball team got slaughtered 184-0. "How can we lose when we're so sincere?"
Thank you.
Now for this month's cover story, The Passion of Dwayne Johnson. He's wrestled with more than meets the eye, a volatile childhood, and a heartbreaking relationship with his dad, not to mention his candy-ass nemesis Vin Diesel. On the eve of his new movie, Red Notice, the megastar and entrepreneur, first known as The Rock, drinks his tequila and tells his truth, by Chris Heath, with photographs by Mark Seliger, styled by Ilaria Urbanati. Opening photo shows Dwayne Johnson wearing a white-ribbed, sleeveless tank, muscular, tattooed biceps exposed, and his face is shown in profile as he has a very serious look on his face. During one of our last conversations, Dwayne Johnson's 5-year-old daughter, Jasmine, comes into his office to ask, a little impatiently, when he will be able to eat some lemon cake with her. She has walked into the middle of a discussion about whether her father truly has presidential ambitions. Earlier this year, after a poll suggested that 46% of Americans have some enthusiasm for this recurrently floated idea, Johnson responded on Instagram, where he currently has 270 million followers, the second most of anyone on the planet, I don't think our founding fathers ever envisioned a 6'4", bald, tattooed, half-black, half-Samoan, tequila-drinking, pickup-truck-driving, fanny-pack-wearing guy joining their club. But if it ever happens, it'd be my honor to serve you, the people. Johnson and I go back and forth on this strange subject for some time as he tries to honestly describe where he stands. He explains that he finds the idea humbling, concedes that he has talked to people in politics and done a small amount of research and analysis to see where this comes from and to see what it could look like in the future, and adds suggestively that indicators are all very positive, in, for example, 2024, and in, for example, 2028. He is not, he confirms, ruling the possibility out. But when he loops back to this, you know, at the end of the day, I don't know the first thing about politics. I don't know the first thing about policy. I care deeply about our country. I care about every effing American who bleeds red, and that's all of them. And there's no delusion here. I may have some decent leadership qualities, but that doesn't necessarily make me a great presidential candidate. That's where I am today. This is when Jasmine appears to declare her more lemon cake-related agenda. As soon as I'm done, I'm going to come out and see you, okay? Her father tells her gently. Then he asks her a question. Do you know what the President of the United States is? Jasmine shakes her head. We're actually talking about that right now, he explains. Oh, she says, if Daddy can become the President of the United States, Johnson clarifies. Jasmine, by way of answer or comic accident, indicates the ice and tequila-filled tumbler on Johnson's desk and asks a question of her own. Are you drinking this? Dwayne Johnson was once a professional wrestler known as The Rock. Aside from his physical capabilities, he was celebrated for the exaggerated way he would raise his right eyebrow and for an array of cartoonish, pugnacious catchphrases like, if you smell what The Rock is cooking, and The Rock will layeth the smacketh down all over your candy ass. Johnson sold these lines with great verve and displayed a rare command over wrestling audiences. Even so, when he set his sights on Hollywood, there was little reason to imagine he had the skills that might sustain a long-lasting second career. For his first starring movie role in a spirited, serviceable, historical action fantasy romp called The Scorpion King, he was billed only as The Rock. To promote it, Johnson was booked on Howard Stern's radio show. At one point during this appearance, Stern and his co-host weighed the possibility that their guest could ever be credited in a movie under his real name. Stern was particularly incredulous. As Dwayne, Stern said, who's going to go to a Dwayne Johnson movie? I mean, honestly. That was 19 years ago. I think it'd be fair to say that the results are now in. The simple empirical truth is this. Dwayne Johnson is the most successful movie star in the world and has been for some time. For each of the last 5 years, he was, according to Forbes' annual list, either the highest or second highest paid actor. In that period, he is estimated to have earned a total of $430.4 million. It sits me down, says Johnson, mulling the circumstance. It sits me down. That was never the goal. The goal was just, I didn't want to be broke. And I didn't want my family to be broke anymore. In person, for our first meeting, we're sitting in a Los Angeles hotel room, and he's idly nursing a different glass of tequila. His affect is far more reflective and soft-spoken than it usually is in the movies that have made him all this money. And it's a blessing, man. Are you kidding me? It's a blessing. It's a blessing. It's a blessing. A few days later, Johnson heads alone to the gym. He and his wife, Lauren, and his two young daughters, Jasmine and Tiana, are living in a Los Angeles rental while their new house is being built. So he temporarily has his private gym elsewhere. Johnson is driving himself, as he always likes to, in one of the four pickup trucks he owns. I'm a pickup truck guy, he will tell me later, so I have big tires and a big pickup truck. It belongs in the country, but it rolls through this hood. On this particular morning, as Johnson nears a stoplight, he realizes that he will be drawing alongside an open-topped big bus celebrity homes and lifestyle tour bus. Johnson's driver's side window is down, and he leaves it down. He begins to film what happens next, himself in frame. Hey, you guys, he says out the window. You know where I could find the Rock? The rest is shock, awe, and manic photo-taking. Ah, well, that was fun, says Johnson to the camera. Good way to start off my Saturday. Johnson is not the first celebrity to surprise a bus tour, but it doesn't feel like he's acting out of duty or a need for attention or as a prank or even, well, maybe just a little, because he knows it'll make for good Instagram content. When I ask him about it later, he simply says, it's one of the joys, and I believe he means this. The more I talk to Johnson, the more I believe that he genuinely does see moments like this as fun. Fun for them, and fun for him. Fun all around. When I mention how many of his neighbors must roll up their darkened windows at that point, he responds, yeah, I'm sure they do. I think they're missing out. It's one of the best parts of fame, you know, to make people feel good. Oh, it's the best. I do that all the time. Later, he brings this up again to append a further thought. There was a time when no one knew who I was, nor gave a shit. I roll the windows down as a reminder. What an incredible position to be in. You got a chance to make somebody's day. Johnson's friend Oprah Winfrey detects something distinctive at work here. Most people have the "Do you see me, Gene?" she says, but he truly has the "I see you, Gene." And I think the reason why he's adored is because he is adoring of other people. He really is what he appears to be, and people know that. The Johnson philosophy, fun for them, fun for him, also animates the movies he makes. It is as simple as it sounds. Let's make people feel good, he says. And this goal also determines, to some degree, what he chooses to do in front of the camera. There are a lot of actors, and a lot of my friends, that utilize the platform of acting to explore their emotional shit. What has worked for me is a lighter touch, as it relates to that. I would prefer not to explore my emotional shit in my movies, because for me, that's my responsibility to go figure out. That's a lot of sludge. It's more important to me to impact as many people as possible on day one. I don't need acting to work out my personal shit. I work it out on my own. Don't worry. Johnson has had plenty of sludge in his real life. There was enough incident and torment in his early years that if you, say, lightly fictionalized it, you could probably make a lessons learned network TV show out of it all. As they have, the second season of Young Rock returns to NBC in the new year after a one-off Christmas special. Johnson was born into professional wrestling. His black Canadian father, Rocky Johnson, was a successful wrestler, as was his Samoan maternal grandfather, Peter Maivia. This was wrestling before the large national audiences and big paydays. It wasn't an easy life. Dwayne was born 49 years ago in Hayward, near San Francisco, but his family frequently moved wherever a sustained period of wrestling work could be found. There are two particular moments in Johnson's life that he often refers to as low points, from which he derives motivation. The second occurred much later, when, in the final indignity of his failed football career, he was cut from the Canadian Football League at the age of 22. As he was being driven back to live with his parents, he searched through his pockets to find all the money he had in the world, a five, a one, and some change. Johnson would memorialize the moment in the name of his film company, Seven Bucks Productions. The first event came when he was 14. The family had been based in Hawaii for some time, but his father was off wrestling in Tennessee. One day, he and his mother came home to their Hawaii apartment to find a padlock and an eviction notice. His mother was distraught. That was a defining moment, he says. I remember at 14 thinking, I will never, ever have my parents go through this again. What followed was a particularly tumultuous period. Johnson, now just turned 15, was sent ahead to Nashville, where instead of staying with his father, as he expected, he moved into a seedy motel room with one of his father's wrestling friends, Bruno Lauer. Who the F is Bruno? Johnson remembers wondering. Nonetheless, the two of them struck up an unusual friendship. Johnson's role was to drive Lauer to his downtown Nashville drinking haunts, as well as to keep them both well supplied with anything they needed. Johnson had learned to steal in Hawaii. Back then, it was mainly clothes. I just didn't want to wear the same old shorts and t-shirt and flip-flops every day. Though he would also lift a king-size Snickers from the same 7-Eleven every day between 4 and 4:30 in the afternoon as he walked the 3 or 4 miles to the gym. Just breezed in, breezed out, without buying anything else. They had to have known, he now reflects. In Nashville, Johnson used the same skills. He'll tell you himself he was a thief, Lauer tells me. Bruno, you want some cigarettes? I got you a quart of beer. I got us some hot dogs, some this, some that. I got me a radio. Johnson would pretend that people had given him the stuff for free because they were fans of Lauer or of his father. But, of course, Lauer knew the truth. Hell, back then I didn't have any morals either, Lauer says. I was benefiting too. Next photo, peace out. Dwayne Johnson at a private residence in Malibu, California. And here he sits in a very zen yoga pose in a shallow pool of water in an Asian-themed garden. And he is fully dressed in long-sleeved sweater and trousers. No shoes, of course. Johnson's mother arrived in Tennessee about a month after her son. Johnson knew that his father had been seeing someone else and that trouble was looming. Within minutes of her arrival, his mother spotted the Illinois plates on the vehicle her husband was driving and demanded, "Whose car is that?" The fight started in the motel. "Not physical, but a massive fight," says Johnson. And then they took a pause so that the warring parents and their teenage son could have an uneasy meal at Shoney's Big Boy. "You can imagine," he says, "what that lunch was like." That evening, Rocky was due to wrestle in a town maybe 100 miles away. So after the fighting resumed in the parking lot, they headed off. Johnson's parents drove ahead in the car with the Illinois plates, and he followed them onto I-65 in the car his mother had driven from California. Even from behind, he could see that his parents were continuing to fight. A few miles outside Nashville, the car his father was driving abruptly swerved onto the gravel. "My mom gets out, completely glazed over in her eyes, and walks into I-65, walks in the middle of the highway," Johnson says, "into traffic, big rigs swerving, like she felt, what has my life come to? I don't care anymore." Johnson rushed from his car, ran into the traffic, grabbed his mother, and pulled her to the side of the road. To this day, his mother remembers nothing of that moment. "I think what breaks her heart is that I saw it, and I pulled her from the highway," Johnson says. "That's the part that really hurts her." I ask him whether that day on I-65 was the end of his parents' marriage. "No," he says, "that was in 87, and they didn't get a divorce until I was 34 years old, which would have made it 2006. My mom always felt that she wanted to stay in the marriage and make it work. She only changed her mind when her son was able to buy her own house. She asked Johnson to sit with them while she broke the news to Rocky. As for Johnson's life of larceny, that would finally end the following year. In the fall of 1987, the three of them moved to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Winter was closing in, and Johnson needed warm clothes, so he obtained some and got caught. His mother came down to the police station to get him. Later, back home, she broke down and pleaded with him not to do it anymore. In Hawaii, he'd been arrested several times, but they had family connections there and could count on some leniency. Not here. In that moment, Johnson says, he realized something. "I started caring that night. I'll never forget it. I'll never forget going to bed going, of all the shit my mom has been through, and that I have been right there watching and witnessing, now I am compounding it with my dumbass decisions." And he never stole anything, ever again? No, that was it. Johnson pauses. Sometimes he just can't help himself. Only hearts, he adds. As for his father, Johnson says that the incident on I-65 triggered a real anger for my dad from me. Going forward, their relationship was forever complicated. For instance, at the end of his football career, Johnson told his father he wanted to become a wrestler, and his father initially spurned him. "I said, I want to get into the business," Johnson says, then recounts his father's reaction. "Absolutely not. You got nothing to offer." But then his father relented and trained him. Over time, their relationship would get better, but it would never get easy. "The irony is, I effing idolized my dad as a boy," he says. "I idolized him, man." And obviously that idealization started to wane over the years. But the older I got, and the more experienced I got, the more I could appreciate his love for me in that limited capacity. Johnson met his first wife, Danny Garcia, when he was 18. They were both at the University of Miami, where Johnson believed himself on track to become an NFL star. In 2001, they had a daughter, Simone, but by the summer of 2007, they were divorcing. It somehow seems characteristic of Johnson's story that even this defeat would morph into a different kind of victory. A year or so after they split, Garcia took charge of Johnson's management, and their business partnership has been at the center of his accomplishments since, in movies and far beyond. When Johnson first met Lauren, a musician and singer whose father, Siv Haishian, was Boston's drummer in the band's heyday, he says that he presented her with what he calls the suit of armor, which was, everything is great, life is great, going through divorce, yes, but it's great. Have a child who's 5 or 6 at that time, it's great. A few months later, when it was clear things were getting serious between them, he realized that he needed to let her in. And that truth was, things are effing hard, and this divorce is tough, and it's kicking my ass. And I'm really struggling, trying to figure out what kind of father I can be, and not trying to bring the baggage of my own relationship, my complicated relationship with my own dad, to this relationship with Simone. I don't know what the F is going on, what's going to happen in my career, because things, they're not hitting the way I'd anticipated. So I had done a little bit of ripping myself open to her and sharing the truth and feelings, like, if we have a shot at a life together, and if you're going to love me, then the best version that I could give that is worthy of your love is one that's truthful. So I'm working hard. I'm trying. I don't have all the effing answers at all, and I want you to know that truth. That was almost 15 years ago. They were finally married in August 2019 in Hawaii, the ocean before them, in a small family ceremony that they managed to stage without word leaking beforehand. The wedding itself was at 9 in the morning. In taking their vows, Johnson said not I do, but absolutely do. I think I have had to be nothing but myself with Lauren, he tells me, and she has had to be nothing but herself with me. In its own sweet way, their wedding night honored that contract. Back at the hotel, when he realized that Lauren was exhausted, he told her that she should just go to bed. Johnson himself wasn't tired, so he sat in the other room with all these cheat foods that he'd ordered, chocolate chip cookies and cheesecake and vanilla ice cream, and poured himself a tequila. Then he flicked through the available movies, landing on the Elton John fantasy biopic Rocket Man. Really enjoyed it. So, he says, softly amused, my wedding night, yeah, was me and Elton and sugar and tequila. On the day when lemon cake awaits, Jasmine will actually interrupt our conversation more than once. The first time, Johnson introduces us and tells his daughter that he and I first knew each other a long time ago. This is true. Johnson and I spent 3 days together back in 2002 when he was promoting the Scorpion King. First, I accompanied him to wrestling shows in Detroit and Cleveland, Johnson driving me between the two cities. He had, I recall, a rather contrary attitude toward one-way streets. Ah, well, he laughs when I remind him of this, no cop, no stop, you know. Then we took a private plane to Cancun, where he was filming a spring break show for MTV. He knew Daddy 20 years ago, Johnson tells Jasmine now. 20 years ago, she says, as though trying to conceive of this. When I was wrestling, Johnson explains. He was wrestling with you? Jasmine asks, peering at me with what I fear is a certain skepticism. He wishes, says Johnson. I ask Jasmine if she thinks that had I been a wrestler, I would have won. No, she says. It clearly means something to Johnson that we shared these previous experiences. I'm sure, knowing myself back then, I probably kept up a veneer that didn't tell you how nervous I was, he says. That guy back then, oh man, he was nervous as an MF and didn't know what was going on, and he was flying by the seat of his pants. After the Scorpion King, Johnson's career seemed to thrive for a while, then tapered off. He had been doing what he had been advised was required to build Hollywood credibility, putting as much distance as possible between himself and his wrestling past as The Rock, losing weight and bulk to appear more normal, even though in his gut something felt off. Eventually, Johnson brought his CAA agents together for a reboot and told them he had his eye on Will Smith's and George Clooney's careers. I said, "Those are the guys who are on top. And I don't know how, but I feel like if we can all go shoulder to shoulder on this, I feel like there's a pathway to that kind of success, only different, and maybe better or bigger." Johnson was hoping that at least some of those in the room would somehow see what he saw. They did not. "If I had thought bubbles of everybody in that room at that time," he reflects, "it was probably, 'What effing drugs are you on?'" So he and his ex-wife built a new team. One pivotal part of the ascent that followed was the huge success of his appearances in the Fast and Furious film franchise. Fast Five, in which his character Luke Hobbs was introduced, would nearly double the previous installment's gross, something that Johnson acknowledges really lit a rocket under my market value in our business. He returned for the next three films, as well as the spin-off Hobbs and Shaw. But behind the scenes, there had been a growing schism between Johnson and Vin Diesel, serious enough that Johnson only agreed to return for the series' eighth installment, The Fate of the Furious, on the condition that he and Diesel shared no scenes. "I wanted to forego drama," he tells me. "I thought that that was the best thing to do for everybody." It clearly wasn't enough. Their issues sprung into the open with a now notorious Instagram post that Johnson wrote a week before the end of production. He subsequently deleted it, but not before it had traveled far and wide. It read, in part, "My female co-stars are always amazing, and I love them. My male co-stars, however, are a different story. Some conduct themselves as stand-up men and true professionals, while others don't." The ones that don't are too chicken shit to do anything about it anyway. Candy asses. When you watch this movie next April, and it seems like I'm not acting in some of these scenes and my blood is legit boiling, you're right. He closed things out with the hashtag zero tolerance for candy asses. Candy ass, as previously mentioned, was one of The Rock's trademark wrestling put-downs. For clarity and at my request, Johnson supplies the following definition. A candy ass is something you don't want to be. And the best way that I can describe a candy ass is, life is so much easier, I have found, when you are not full of shit. And a candy ass is completely full of shit. I ask Johnson whether something specific had happened on set to provoke his post. "Nothing specific happened, just the same old shit," he says, "and that just wasn't my best day." "Because of what happened," I ask, or because he chose to share it on Instagram, chose to share it. "He regretted it?" Johnson laughs. "It caused a firestorm, yet interestingly enough, it was as if every single crew member found their way to me and either quietly thanked me or sent me a note. But yeah, it wasn't my best day sharing that. I shouldn't have shared that. Because at the end of the day, that goes against my DNA. I don't share things like that. And I take care of that kind of bullshit away from the public. They don't need to know that. That's why I say it wasn't my best day." But I confirm he wouldn't take it back. He just wouldn't share it publicly. "No, I meant what I said, for sure. I mean what I say when I say it, but to express it publicly was not the right thing to do." It was subsequently reported that some kind of peace meeting took place soon afterward in Johnson's trailer. Well, there was a meeting, Johnson tells me, laughing. I wouldn't call it a peaceful meeting. I would call it a meeting of clarity. He and I had a good chat in my trailer, and it was out of that chat that it really became just crystal clear that we are two separate ends of the spectrum, and agreed to leave it there. Johnson says that he and Diesel are philosophically two different people, and we approach the business of movie making in two very different ways. The faults he sees in Diesel seem pretty clear from this description he offers of his own contrasting philosophy. It's the philosophy of going into work every day, looking at everybody as equal partners, and looking at the studio as equal partners, and looking at the crew, regardless of where you're at, either on the call sheet or otherwise, as equal partners, with respect and with humility, and being respectful of the process and every other human being who is putting in just as much time, just as much hard work and sweat equity, if not more. And I think that's always been important to me, to always be straight up and look somebody in the eye. And if you say you're going to do something, do it. Over time, Diesel has voiced his own oblique observations about this situation. He has put down their differences to them being two alpha males. Johnson sounds like him to say that, sure. Characterized Johnson, perhaps slightly patronizingly, as Hollywood's second multicultural megastar, whom he's proud to see following in his footsteps. Johnson, he talks like that, and said that, I protected Dwayne more than he'll ever know, but he appreciates it. He knows he only has one big brother in the film world, and that's me. Johnson, I have one big brother, and it's my half-brother, and that's it. Then, this summer, in an interview in Men's Health, Diesel returned to the subject, casting any conflict as the benign side effect of purposeful method of manipulation on his part. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.